Welcome to High Truths on Drugs and Addiction, where national experts bring you facts and answers. I'm your host, Dr. Onit Lev, an emergency and addiction doctor who has served at the White House and practiced on the front lines. Right here on High Truths, you will learn from experts from around the globe and around all aspects of drugs and addiction. High Truths is more than a podcast. It's a movement to unite physical, mental, and addiction health. It brings innovations to connect public health, public safety, and prevention. Our discussions inspire people to implement programs that save lives. To grow this community of information and action, I hope you give us a five-star review. Come visit me on hightruths.com. Today's episode is sponsored by Drug-Free America Foundation, tackling the pervasive issue of substance use and its far-reaching impacts on individuals, families, and community. Drug-Free America is supporting ISAC, the International Academy on the Science and Impact of Cannabis, doctors and scientists educating on the harms of marijuana. Hello again, High Truth listeners. Get ready for an advocacy conversation. I'm your host, Dr. Onit Lev. Advocacy, as in enough is enough in terms of drug deaths. I can't change the world, but I'm going to step up and do something in my circle. I've met so many heroes in this podcast and in my life, people who turn pain into purpose, people who are inspiring. They don't just complain, they find solutions. People who push against the stream and make things happen in a big way or in a small way. It all adds up. These are the people who motivate me to continue to not just save lives from drugs, but create a resilient generation of Americans that are not susceptible to drugs. Life is hard, and there are healthier ways to manage the difficulties rather than turning to drugs. To learn more about advocacy, I reach out to Jan Rader. Jan Rader joined the Huntington, West Virginia Fire Department in August 1994 and became the first woman city fire chief. Since retiring from the fire department, she's been serving as a member of the mayor's Office of Drug Control Policy, the city's drug czar. And Jan became a movie star with the release of the short documentary Heroin by Netflix. In April 2018, she was chosen as one of Time Magazine's 100 most influential people in the world. To learn more about Jan Rader, check out the High Truths show notes. Jan Rader, welcome to High Truths.
Well, thank you for inviting me. It's a pleasure.
It is for me, too. Very excited to have this conversation and get to know you better. Very thankful to our previous drug czar, Jim Carroll, for connecting us. And I thought we'd start a little bit about your background. I consider you an advocate, and the theme of this podcast is advocacy. Do you see yourself that way as well?
Absolutely. You know, being a first responder, firefighter, paramedic, old paramedic, and a nurse, you know, advocacy is a big part of all three of those professions, and I certainly don't take it lightly. So, there's an old saying, once a nurse, always a nurse. So once an advocate, always an advocate.
That's right. It's in your profession, but also in your day-to-day life. Yeah. And you're the first female fire chief, really male-dominated world. How did that happen? And I'm sure it wasn't easy.
Yeah, it was, interesting. I started my career as a firefighter in 1994 in Huntington, West Virginia. Didn't even realize that it was an option for women to enter the fire service until I witnessed a heart attack in the doorway of a store where I was working in Tyson Corner Center. And I was assistant manager of a jewelry store. And I called 911 because I felt helpless and I didn't know what to do. And the first people who arrived, somebody was doing CPR, a young lady was doing CPR on the lady until the fire department arrived and there was a woman firefighter. And so that's when I became intrigued, and I was always very athletic. And so I looked into it, and I grew up within 20 miles of Huntington, West Virginia. So that's where I landed. So kind of came up through the ranks, never dreamed of being a fire chief, just, you know, took tests, became promoted throughout my career, and then, was put in that position. So, I mean, it was an honor to serve as the fire chief. So it just kind of happened.
Was it Was it harder for you as a woman? I know as a physician, especially when I was younger, it would be hard for patients to know that I was a doctor. They'd still call me the nurse. Did you have anything like that as a fire chief?
Constantly. So, but that's okay. I mean, I get it. Until there is a wider number, a larger number of women in non-traditional roles, we can anticipate those questionings, so.
Yeah. And I think that probably like me, where it's like, it's okay if they got it wrong,
Yeah, I'm not offended by it, so.
Yeah.
Your fame in this area is your association with Huntington, West Virginia. Tell us about Huntington and what makes it special.
I think that Huntington is a small town. It's the second largest city in West Virginia with only 46,000 people. It's the county seat of Cabell County, which only has about 95,000 people. So it is a larger city for West Virginia, but it is technically a small town in Appalachia. It is located in the only state that is completely Appalachian. And, so it has very unique values. We're very community oriented and helping those who cannot help themselves. We are very good at figuring out problems, troubleshooting. It's a unique area.
What makes it susceptible to the fentanyl and the drugs?
So, Appalachian in general, the region was targeted by a couple companies when they were doing some false marketing on pills for strong pills that are less addictive or non-addictive, in particular OxyContin. When you're dealing with an area that is has a lot of blue collar workers that have a lot of injuries, that's a good testing ground, I would say. There are emails proving that we were targeted as a region to test out a strong medication that was made and falsely advertised at the time. So, we're just, I think that's probably it, could have been any area of the country, but they chose Appalachia.
It became the number one area for drug deaths. Is it still that way or have things changed?
It is still that way. I think our numbers are moving in a positive direction right now, currently. I think people call us ground zero. I don't know if we're ground zero, but I think things have hit here first, which also gives us the opportunity to be a center of solutions and to do research and find out what it works so that other areas of the country do not experience exactly what we have.
Yeah.
We try to turn it into a positive.
Yes. So you really got involved in this issue, not just, overdose after overdose after overdose and responding and something that like grits at your soul, surrounded by death, but going upstream and making some solutions in your area. Can you tell us about that?
I was very fortunate to work in a city where we have really good, positive, strong leadership. Mayor Williams, who has led the city of Huntington for 12 years, he had met Michael Botticelli, who was the drug czar at one point. He had come to Huntington. And, when he realized the magnitude of what we were dealing with, he decided as a leader, a politician, that we were going to admit we had a serious problem and we were going to hit it head on. And, you don't see a lot of leaders doing that when you have a significant issue in your community. And he put me and some other people together and he said, try to make some change. And every time we would come to him and say, we need this or we need that, and he'd say, why? Explain it. And he'd say, okay, let's do this. One of the first things we did was try to keep real-time data, you know, every data that we could find on overdoses, hepatitis B, HIV was two-year-old data. It took that long to vet it. So we needed to keep real-time non-vetted data so that we could make a positive change, because 2 years was too long to know what you're doing and how you're doing it, if it's making a difference. So we developed our own method locally to keep real-time data. It wasn't vetted data. We recognized that. We advertised it as such, but that led us to be able to start making positive change and developing a system of dealing with what we were seeing. And one of the first things that data taught us was this is moving and changing very quickly. And so we worked with our state legislative body to make sure that state law allowed for all first responders to not only carry naloxone, but make it mandatory that all first responders carry naloxone. And so we started saving more people instead of finding them deceased. You know, that is a big, one of the big changes that we did immediately. And that was Mayor Williams put together an Office of Drug Control Policy. It was myself. It was a crime analyst from the local police department, Huntington Police Department. And it was Jim Johnson, who was retired police officer who had served as interim police chief for some time. So, you know, we started educating our stakeholders, and we started with the faith community, and we met with 10 or less people at a time. And we did so that we could have those hard conversations about how individuals feel about addiction, and about severe mental illness and anything involved, so that we could deal with those very localized. What we found out from our faith community was that they were wanting to help immensely, but they also were starving for education on how they could help their congregation. So with those meetings with our faith leaders, we developed a 6-week program to educate our faith leaders on how they could better assist their congregations that were growing in number of people suffering from substance use disorder. You know, so a lot of things happened organically as we moved along. You know, I think a lot of people, you know, look back and judge and why did you do this? Why didn't you do that or whatever? But, you know, I think that even though we are still hit hard, I can't imagine how desperate Huntington would be had we not started a lot of the programs that we did. And a lot of other communities around the country try to duplicate what we do.
Yeah.
Our partnerships, our collaborations, our innovative solutions. So,
yes, working together as a community is also very key. You know, I was really impressed by some of the program that you did. I wrote an article about ACEs. You know, ACEs usually stands for Adverse Childhood Experiences, but I switched that to Adverse Career Experiences. And if you're, you know, letting parents know that their child died day after day, I just got an email just before our call from a law enforcement officer in Massachusetts, and it must grit at his soul to have to do this again and again and again. And I think that that's an adverse career experience. But one of the things you did is take care of the caregivers. And I love that. Can you tell us about that?
So Mayor Williams said we have a grant opportunity with Bloomberg. Bloomberg Philanthropies put out, a little segment asking for people submitting for a Mayor's Challenge grant. It was $1 million over 3 years, I think was the grant. And so he brought several of us together, several of his leadership team members, and he said, find me a problem that we can solve with $1 million over 3 years. And, There were five of us, and we decided, and I had been harping and complaining about compassion fatigue with our first responders for a long time. It was just unprecedented what we were seeing. We had 1,831 overdoses in 2017. That was our peak. That was non-fatal overdoses. We had 202 fatal overdoses. So, just doing quick math, the average firefighter probably saw or could have seen up to five young deaths per month, and these are their classmates, their friends. So, we pushed the compassion fatigue. And so we submitted a grant application, and we were invited to do a test model of what we selected as a problem to solve at a city level. We were given $100,000 and given 8 months to try to see if it would work. And we made some serious errors and we had some failures, but we reported those and we reported how we would correct that. And we were granted $1 million over 3 years. We were one of nine grantees around the country, and each community was tackling a different issue in their community. So with that, we created Compass Navigating Wellness, and our police and fire departments participate in that. EMS is run by the county, so it's a different government agency. So we include police and fire, so you're talking about 200 individuals. With this program, we have embedded a mental fitness coach and a physical fitness coach. They do ride-alongs on the fire trucks. They go on ride-alongs with police officers. They respond to scenes if leadership feels that their presence is needed. For instance, we had a fire in 2020 where a young father and three small children perished. And we called the mental fitness coach to the scene so she could start working with the firefighters and police officers that were on scene and witnesses. And it made a huge difference. And this program is actually designed to be run for them, by them. They have an advisory committee. They have focus groups. They decide what programming they want. They decide what education they need. They wanted their own workout facility or center that even significant others do not attend. Children do not attend. Outsiders do not attend. It's just for first responders. And we have built that. We raised the money outside of that grant funding, and we've created this space. The embedded mental fitness coach, she does not do counseling. She farms out. She vets all the mental health counselors that we send first responders to. And we are seeing big success with that. We're seeing people turn to mindfulness and yoga instead of the bottle and drinking. And, our whole goal with this program is for people to, when they retire, to be a whole person, mind, body, and spirit. Not just be physically okay, because the suicide rate is so high with our first responders. So I think this is a replicable program, and we do have, we have had other communities come in to see what we're doing, especially Louisville Police Department has, I think they're doing their own program. But I think it's also key that the police chief and the fire chief don't tell them what to do, or the mayor. They decide what they need, and it's theirs. So it's, I think we're going to see that this is going to be the norm, and it's going to be very helpful.
Yeah. I relate to that as emergency physicians. People usually attack, it's so hard to go to the ER, and they're like, they're stressed, and maybe they weren't so nice. And we have the number one burnout profession in all of medicine. It's embarrassing. It's not where you want to be, number one. And that type of care is important. And I read that they were doing cooking classes, massages. Again, this was not your idea. This is what they said that they would like to do.
Yes. And we've done tests with everything. Everything's you know, if we want something new, a focus group is chosen. They test it out, and then they decide if it's best for everybody or not. Like, we have three giant massage chairs in our center. There's three people on a fire truck. So if they have a bad call, they can go to the center while they're on duty. I wrote a, before I left as the fire chief, I wrote a policy. They came to me and said, we would like to be able to go to the center while we're on duty. And so I sat down with the union and we wrote out a policy that allowed them to go for 1 hour a day to the center and be on delayed response. The shift commander decides who gets what time slot, you know, based on who asks about when. And they can sit in that massage chair after a bad call and they can chill out a little bit. And I think that would be a wonderful thing to have a quiet room in a hospital where once you've had a serious issue or a serious patient in the emergency room, if you need to take 15, 20 minutes and go sit quietly to gather yourself, that you can do that. I think that that's something that desperately is needed in any type of critical care. I mean, I used to work on my days off.
I think a thank you would go a long way. We're like a profession that doesn't get thanked.
I used to work on my days off in the emergency room at a local trauma center as an ER nurse, you know, from the fire department. So I understand how awful it can be. You could have a horrible day. Yeah. And with no recognition of that.
Yeah.
No validation of what you're going through. And that's not good for your mental health.
No. And if anything, it's the other way around. You need to go. Right. Now, your experience has really made you an expert in leadership. What key leadership pearls can you share with us?
You know, I think that, you know, as leaders, we need to meet our employees where they are. You know, we can't make assumptions, you know, that they know or have basic knowledge that we think they should have, you know, generationally or whatever. But we also need to meet them where they are emotionally and with what they do day in and day out. And I think as leaders, we need to listen more.
Wow. Listening, right? They say, I always hear that. God gave you one mouth and two ears in that proportion.
And that's the truth.
I need to learn that too, remind myself. And then you became a movie star, Jan. How cool is that? Tell us what that was like.
Well, that was interesting. You know, we had some young filmmakers actually from West Virginia, a married couple come to town and they wanted, you know, they were losing their classmates from high school to overdose death. And they kept hearing that they're doing good things in Huntington. And so they came to Huntington and we showed them around and they found some grant funding to do a little documentary. And of course, Mayor Williams was like, of course we will participate. And, you know, we never dreamed that the documentary would be anything big, but it ended up kind of blowing up a little bit. It's called Heroin with an E in parentheses at the end. It's only 39 minutes long. But, you know, I think that, you know, it was released on Netflix. And I think what it did was give people an opportunity to talk about a very difficult situation that might be going on in their own life. You know, I'm still to this day approached on a regular basis by people. And if they approach me, I always listen because I know that they're approaching me because they've had some tragedy in their life, some trauma in their life. And, you know, so it's been an interesting ride. How's that?
Yeah. The film starred the heroines, the women, the fire chief, the judge, and real estate, all power chicks of West Virginia. Tell us about the other ones, the judge and the real estate agent.
So Judge Keller is a family court judge. She's actually one of my best friends, and she helped start a drug court in 2009 in Cabell County. And she ran the drug court until 2018, and then it was turned over to another judge, you know, but she was the founder of that drug court. And her compassion really comes through. You know, she holds people accountable. She's tough, but she's also very compassionate. And Nisha Freeman is, you know, pretty much a street minister to prostitutes. that are prostituting to feed their addiction. This woman is a force. She is a real estate agent by trade. She does not give up on women. I have seen her help put people back through rehab multiple times. She's just amazing. She's still out there, what we call brown bagging. She takes food out to prostitutes every Wednesday in Huntington, and she fights fiercely for them, for their health, for getting services. About 6 months ago, hooked her up with the health department to create a new program to try to get more testing for her girls. And, she's just, if you could clone her over and over again, she's just an amazing person.
Yeah. One-on-one caring.
Yes.
Yeah. And what are they doing now? What are the judges still, are they still working in this field in West Virginia?
Judge Keller is still a family court judge, although the drug court is run by a circuit court judge now. Nisha is still selling real estate, and she is still ministering to her girls. So, we all are still really good friends.
And the three of you all went to the Oscars. Is that right?
We did get to go to the Oscars. The documentary was nominated. We were in the third balcony. I had no clue that there were three balconies in that arena where the Oscars are held.
Is that like the nosebleed section?
We were in the nosebleed section of the nosebleed, but we were there and it was fun.
And did you trade your uniform for a fancy gown?
I did wear a dress. I wouldn't say it's incredibly fancy, but I still refuse to wear makeup.
That's great. That was wonderful. I'm sure that was an experience.
It was.
Let's talk about current advocacy. The way we got together is your incident on an airplane and somebody who, overdosed several thousand miles up in the air. Tell us a little bit about that and where you want to go with that.
Yeah, so, I was on a plane going to a speaking engagement. There was a medical emergency on board. They asked for assistance. I said, I'm a nurse. I'm happy to help. And it ended up being an overdose. And I asked the flight attendant if they had Narcan, and she said, "What's that?" And that, so I happened to have a dose of naloxone in my carry-on bag, which is a reversal drug for an opiate overdose, and I administered it. And after that incident, I was bothered by the fact that, now there was naloxone later on. We found out there was naloxone in a bag that only a physician can open on the plane because it has other very serious medications in it, which I certainly understand. But I didn't understand why naloxone could not be available on a plane for just anybody to use in that situation, because that individual could have lost his life without that life-saving drug, and that is not okay with me. So I reached out to a couple people, but the real mover and shaker, of course, is Jim Carroll, who was our national drug czar under Trump's first term, and then he said, let's work on this. And he brought you into the picture and also Brent. Or is it St. Brent?
Yeah. He's a physician with the FAA.
Yes. Yeah, so, sometimes it just takes talking about a problem to as many people as possible and planting little seeds. And you all are movers and shakers, so you're advocates just like I am. So it just worked out.
Yeah, and we learned that this is going to happen. Of course, yes. Being in the emergency field, it's always too slow for us.
Oh, always.
Always too slow, but it's moving, and we'll continue to push for that.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely.
Now, as far as advocacy, there's different size of the advocacy problem with drugs. And I'm sure in your role now, you're dealing both with the supply side and the demand side. Supply side nationally, you know, working with families against fentanyl. And I love what, you know, President Trump says that he's going to really choke at the supply side because the supply really matters. That's on a federal level, but also on a local level, you can deal with the supply side. What do you see on your end in a community?
You know, in my community, we have an excellent drug task force team. You know, our police department works with other law enforcement agencies in the area. They work with federal agencies. The problem is there's so many people willing to step in and be the next drug dealer once they take down somebody at a mid or a high level that is very difficult to keep up with. And it's such a money-making business that, you know, I don't see it stopping anytime soon. People are always going to take that risk to get into that field. So I think we need to keep our foot on the gas when it comes to the supply side, but we also got to keep our foot on the gas with the demand side and try to lessen that desire for the drug.
So before we go on the demand side, the supply side, there are some areas of California where the misguided compassion is to the drug dealer over the victim of the people who died. I don't know if you see that as much in West Virginia, where people are reluctant, they're soft on crime in a way. And I say it's misguided because they think that they're being compassionate to the drug dealer, but they're not. They're being mean to the dealer and mean to the victim as well. You're not giving them the opportunity to recover.
We try to make sure that if you are selling drugs in our town, that we arrest you. If you need help and your victims need help, we want to provide that. But we make it very clear that if you're selling drugs in this town, that we're going to do everything in our power to take you down.
Right. So you have a deterrence. Has to be deterrence. Yeah. Yes. Okay. So demand side. There's demand side upstream and downstream. Downstream is kind of where we are, right? And, you know, the murders, by the time you've overdosed, like how many times? Like people, you know, 10 times. It's like more lives than a cat. And we'll continue to do that. But that's very downstream. And we're also in San Diego, I'm so excited for a project in primary prevention with the goal of preventing, giving life skills to kids at a young age to teach them life skills that they're resilient and to prevent drug use or at least delay drug use until your brain is done growing. And we're starting to invest in that. And I'm really excited about that. I don't know if you're doing anything like that as well.
That's amazing. And I think that's what it's going to take. We've got to stop several things. Prevention is key. But part of that prevention is I think we need to stop the generational cycle. I think you and I have both seen the first couple waves that were people getting legally hooked on pills and then moving to a needle sticking in their arm or wherever. And kids growing up in this environment where one or both parents are suffering from substance use disorder. Maybe they've lost one or both parents to an overdose. And they might be living with grandma and grandpa, but they don't know anything other than a life of addiction. And we do have a program in Huntington that started a little over 5 years ago, and it's called Project Hope. And what we do is we take women who are pregnant or who have just given birth to possibly a baby with NAS, and we put them in a six-month program. We put them in an apartment, two or three-bedroom apartment with their kids, and it's intensive therapy for 6 months. And we're rebuilding lives with that. We're trying to break that generational cycle. We're even pulling pregnant women out of prison.
Yeah, very focused. That's very focused prevention, and which is important. And then what I mentioned was very universal kind of prevention.
I would love to learn more about your program because we have some mindfulness going on. We have some basic programs, but I think that they need to be souped up.
Yeah. I'm very excited about that because, I learned a lot from the opioid prescriptions and when I see these patients, they'd be with a bucket, like not a bat, a bucket of medications. And I'm like, oh my God, I can't stop these. I just need to somehow keep you alive. And then I realized there'll be, front end. We need to prevent a new generation of Americans who don't get 300 pills when they hurt their back or 50 Vicodins after they get their, wisdom teeth extracted. And that strategy worked. We don't have a prescription problem, really working on that front end. And I think that we invest in kids. And addiction is a pediatric disease. If you talk to our patients, right, when did you first start? They'll say 9 and 10 years old.
It's scary, isn't it?
It's a pediatric disease. So we have to start early. I'm happy to share those resources. There's resources for that type of prevention through HIDA. And then there's another program through called LEAD with law enforcement as educators. So there's several resources. I'd love to see every community in America make this kind of investment.
Excellent.
We do have, I don't know if you have this in your area too. On one hand, I say, oh, we need to invest in this primary prevention. On the other hand, we have billboards everywhere for marijuana and for these magic mushrooms, and we're selling all these candies. And, the number one cause of overdoses for babies in the country is marijuana gummies that they get from their parents.
You're kidding me. I didn't know that.
Yeah, and so we're giving mixed messages to our kids. So I don't know if you're seeing that in your community as well.
I haven't talked to some of my friends that are ER docs in a while, but I know we've had some babies that have gotten into opioids, which is unfortunate.
Yeah, we learned that the hard way. We're baby down. Who thinks a little 6-month-old overdosed on fentanyl? But we learn that that happens, and we put out that education that if baby's down, give naloxone, right? Which isn't like an intuitive thing. We put that information out. And, I saw pictures of you with President Obama hugging you, and then you're friends with Jim Carroll. Kind of opposite sides of the political aisle. So is this a political issue?
I think that this is not a political issue. I think this is a humanist. It's a human issue. It's a generational issue. I think that the last thing we need to do is politicize this. We as humans need to work to help other humans, and it doesn't matter what political side you're on. We're here for each other, and we need to heal as a country, regardless of politics, so.
Yeah. And we know from the death statistics, people don't die with a little D or a little R.
No, they do not.
On them. It is. And I like what you said. It's a human issue. So what do you need now in Huntington, Virginia? What would be your request of a new administration that you would need locally and maybe advice that you would want to see nationally?
I think that nationally, I think that when it comes to developing new programs and policies, you just can't make those decisions in an office not knowing what's going on the front line. So I think that we need to listen to people who are on the front lines, like yourself. We need to listen to our physicians in our emergency rooms. We need to listen to our paramedics, our firefighters, and our police officers. We need to understand how the drug trade is changing, how drug use is changing on the local level before we can affect positive change, I think that we made some policy decisions probably early on that had no flexibility to it. For instance, drug cartels in Mexico seem to control a lot of the product that's on the street in small town USA. And anytime they change the formula, it makes it more difficult for us to deal with that. So any policy written on a federal level needs to have flexibility. So a lot of laws were and things were written with opioids in it. And then all of a sudden now we have methamphetamines in there. And now we have xylazine in there. So we need to have flexibility with wording so that as the climate changes, that we can pivot very quickly to affect positive change.
Yeah, I noticed that. Like the first thing when I went to ONDCP, everything and all the money was going to opioids. And it's like, well, what about meth? Our drug is our number one drug at the time. And still to this day, more than fentanyl is methamphetamines. Like, I mean, so all the money, like, and then I would see things as ridiculous as like, oh, people in the emergency department, oh, you're using, you know, every overdose or anybody using drugs, we were incentivized to really get them into treatment and MAT and Suboxone, and we're doing everything to try to find that one person who's addicted to opioids, that has an opiate use disorder that we could help. And we're so happy when we found one. But then for every one of those, we're throwing out five people who, with methamphetamine, and you're like, oh, you get nothing.
Yeah. So we have found that contingency management works very well with methamphetamines. And, you know, so I would love to see more movement. You know, and contingency management would not just work with methamphetamines. It's going to work with opiates and other things. Right. So I think we just need to be more flexible with our policies. And we certainly can always, you know, putting money into programs that are working to expand those programs, such as PROACT, such as Compass. Navigating wellness. You know, I think that we're going to have a better workforce if we develop programs such as Compass to assist those on the front lines, such as the medical community. You know, I think that's huge.
Yeah. You know, you said earlier that you know, you got the grant for the program, you tried things and they didn't work out. I have a professor, Peter Rosen, may he rest in peace, but he was my mentor for emergency medicine. And he always says, you learn the best from other people's F-ups. He was very colorful in his language.
Yes, you do.
He always said, you know, he was a publisher of journals. And he goes, we should have a journal, all the publications, all the studies that didn't work. It was so we could learn from them instead of just publishing your successes. But so I'm really, you know, proud of you that you were able to, you know, stand up and say, okay, we tried this and it didn't work. Can you tell us a little bit what didn't work? So
what we first tried to do with our first responders when we had that $100,000 and we started focus groups and we tried to force and make it mandatory that our first responders get education. Okay. So let's say one of the classes was Words Matter. Okay. So you bring in your first responders who are completely burnt out, suffering from PTSD, and then you're trying to educate them on how they need to talk in a more controlled manner to the people that...
I know exactly what you're saying. Here they are burnt out, and you're telling them, you're saying it wrong. Don't say addict. That's mean. And it's like, now you're making
them freak out.
I can't even talk right.
Right. So we realized that, you know what? That's not fair to them. They haven't had a chance to de-stress from what they see and do every day. So we stopped making it mandatory. And then we said, okay, you didn't like that class. What do you need? What do you want? What will help you? And we started meeting the first responders where they were instead of trying to preach to them. And it changed everything.
Yeah, I love that attitude, that principle. And Dan, that principle that you just said that you did on a small project is what you're asking the nation to do, right? Not to preach, but to listen and use what you're learning in by listening to make the policies.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
That's great. I love that. Well, Dan, that is amazing. You are a hero, a heroine, and an advocate. And I look forward to working with you on whatever naloxone in the sky or any other project. And if you want any more information on the primary prevention, I'll be happy to connect you.
I would love that. And I would love to help you with anything that you're doing as well. I think that, you know, we were put together for a reason.
That's great. Well, thank you, Dan.
Well, thank you so much.
Thank you for listening to High Truths on Drugs and Addiction, where you learn from experts from around the globe and around all aspects of drugs. This week's episode would not be possible without the generous support of our sponsor. A sincere and warm thank you to Drug Free America Foundation. Visit dfaf.org. And ISAC, the International Academy on the Science and Impact of Cannabis. That's IASIC1.org. High Truths producer is Dave Rivas from Davey Boy Productions. I'm your host, Dr. Onit Lev. We hope we brought your day a little bit more High Truths. Thank you.